following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Good morning and welcome to the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my co-host and partner in crime, Patrick Martins.
Hey, thanks for having me, Katie.
Oh, thanks for coming. And our guest today is the wonderful Ariane Batterbury, who, along with her husband Michael, was the co-founder of Food and Wine Magazine first, and then 10 years later was the co-founder of Food Arts Magazine. So I'm going to give you a little biographical description, because the first project that Ariane and Michael worked on together was the 1973 book On the Town in New York from 1776 to the present.
Which didn't the Washington Post said that was considered the authoritative history of dining in the country's culinary capital?
That's exactly what they said, Patrick.
That is quite a high praise.
It is. Talk about an encomium. And this particular book was a culinary history of New York City, and it was republished in 1998 by Routledge in celebration of the book's 25th anniversary. So that book is still in print, still available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and I highly recommend it. And aside from her work as co-founding two of these milestone national food magazines, Food Arts and Food and Wine, Food Arts is recognized internationally as today's publication of record for the entire table service, restaurant, and hotel industry, with the most influential food figures of the era on its masthead and in its pages. That includes me, by the way, Patrick, just in case you didn't know that.
Are you on the masthead?
I think I am, as a contributing editor, yeah.
Oh.
I am. I'm the meat girl.
Nice.
I'm their resident meathead, and that was... That was Michael recognizing somebody who really had a strange fixation. Anyway, because of your role, Ariane, as founding editor and publisher of Food Arts Magazine, you command a unique and pivotal position in the international spheres of food and drink as an expert and as the ultimate trend spotter. And you were also a pioneer in the electronic publishing industry. And not only that, you had your teletext project called Dining In, and then you also served as a creative consultant to the Time Life IBM Food and Entertaining Laser Discs. I don't even remember what those were. And you helped create Food Facts, an on-site supermarket touchscreen magazine featuring menus, recipes, and coupon printouts.
And also, I think you're the winner with Michael of a Lifetime Achievement Award by James Beard in 2010.
That's right. That was a great
pretty
moment.
Much the highest honor one can get in food, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, thank you so much for coming in, Ariane.
Welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's a great pleasure to have you. Now, the big news for Food Arts is that you just launched an online version of Food Arts Magazine. What's going to be different from the print version?
Well, I should say we're launching in September, mm-hmm. and we are not putting the magazine online. There's a reason for that. We feel the magazine is hugely successful. It's had no fall off whatsoever in terms of subscription, people writing in or emailing in to get the magazine. So what I'm going to do is what we're going to do is put on our website everything you can't get in the magazine. For example, we have a backlist of 2,000 superb recipes, all tested, all used by many restaurants around the country, all by great chefs, and that will be available, all 2,000 recipes.
Wow.
All of our wine information gleaned over the years, that will be available. Tabletop, all of the equipment information. If you want to know what Food Art said about a piece of equipment, it will be online. And we'll have other things. We'll have a job site. We'll have a blog. And what interests me particularly, we'll have a, we'll give our observers, I would say, a chance to voice their opinion. We're going to have controversial questions, and we're going to ask our readers what they think. And that's something also you can't do all that easily in print.
Well, can I just stop you there and ask you what's an example of a controversial question?
Well, the whole question of immigration in the restaurant industry, that's major.
Uh-huh.
So let's consider the various aspects and how they affect the restaurant industry.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's really provocative.
Now, so in a way, the online version of Food Arts is going to be an archive of sorts of the previous issues.
Well, more than an archive, it'll be very lively. It'll be interactive, but it will also possess the archive, so you can get all sorts of information. Because I feel that the web is where people look for specific information. It's not a place people go to read a long article.
Right.
For that, I think people prefer print, and that's where our magazine will continue doing that sort of thing. I think, though, that for searching for quick information, that's what people want on the web, and we're definitely going to give it to them.
Now, how many issues have been published of Food Arts? Like, what issue are you coming up now with your June issue, your kind of Americana issue? How many years has Food Arts been?
Oh, this is our 23rd year.
23rd year, wow.
Yes.
So this online version is going to be an interesting addition to 23 years of journalism. And how are you going to, I mean, and tell us who your readers are, because I know, for instance, there are free subscriptions if you are a chef, correct?
Well, our readers are specifically and uniquely chefs, restaurant owners, and hotel, club, cruise line, food and beverage managers. We go to the people who serve food, and our readers serve well over 13 billion meals a year. So
wow.
we go to the people who serve, prepare the food that you eat out. But at restaurants where you sit down and order and you can have a glass of wine, we don't go to fast food establishments.
Do you have a consumer base in your subscription? I mean, because people can buy a subscription to Food Arts if they're not in the food industry.
People can buy a subscription, but our advertisers basically are focusing on the industry.
Mm-hmm. And when you launch the online version of the magazine, do you think that you'll attract more consumers through that entity, or do you think you'll stay within the same
boundaries? We're going to make every effort to stay within those bounds. And we'll probably have a password, something of that sort.
Oh,
very interesting. And how does one stay on top of trends, you know, within such a, you know, movable kind of industry, you know, cuisine? And Katie and I came up with this question. You know, you're always out in front of food trends and the movement in the restaurant and food industries. How do you manage that?
Well, you know, we do an awful lot of going to restaurants, the whole lot of us. But also, we receive information from all over the country. We receive information from public relations people.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we look and we scour the, you know, various publications nationwide. So we pretty well know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And some of your staff, I know Beverly Stevens, your managing editor, and Barb Mathias, who is, I guess, co-publisher with you now, as well
yes.
as the advertising director. I know both of those ladies travel an awful lot and go to a lot of different events and meet lots of people. I imagine you do as well, Ariane.
Of course.
And is that the main source of your sort of staying ahead of what's going on, or is it really through all of the information that you receive?
It's a combination
it's both,
of both,
yeah.
Obviously, yes.
Very, very interesting. Well, I mean, we have so many questions. I mean, I kind of want to get, just before we get into some of the cool, you know, philosophical questions and historical questions we wanted to ask, how did you come to food and, you know, where were you born, you know, and how did you end up coming to sit as a Lifetime Achievement Award winner for James Beard?
I would say that's a very long story. But one thing, Michael... who passed away recently, but We founded the magazines together. One thing we had in common was both of our parents loved great food, and both took us to wonderful restaurants even when we were very young. So I can remember very clearly places like Le Pavillon back in the early 50s. Mm. I'm old enough to remember really great restaurants, or the Colony. There were just a handful of great restaurants in those days.
And what were they? Pavillon, Colony, these were French restaurants?
Yes. In those days, back in the 50s, haute cuisine was by definition French. And I have to tell you, chefs were by definition Europeans. Mm. They could be French, they could be Italian, but they couldn't be American.
Hmm.
There were no great American chefs until the late 70s.
And who were some of those people in the late 70s who you saw coming up and breaking new ground for this culture?
Well, you know, when we had Food and Wine, we had for our first anniversary a great event at Tavern on the Green, and we had a week of chefs preparing food. And we worked with a group that was called the Jeune Gastronomie, and they were beginning to recognize American chefs. And that at that event, we had not only a superb chef from Italy and two from France, but we also had Paul Prudhomme and Alice Waters. And
this was a great story. I'm just going to jump in one second. Alice tells me this story all the time. She actually came in the plane with a tray full of soil and potted plants. And she took them on the plane with her. She landed at Tavern on the Green. And she and her friends, who were part of the free speech movement, were like, oh, my God, we are in way over our heads. What the hell are we going to do? And Paul Prudhomme, she always, and Michael, you know, coming, they ended up, you know, really helping her. And it was the success of that event that helped to launch her career and that of Chez Panisse's. So it was a very, you know, historic event.
Well, I have to say it was even more historic than that, mm-hmm. because not only did it launch Alice and also to an extent Paul, who was very well known in New Orleans but not outside, mm-hmm. it launched the whole concept of American chefs being great chefs. Everybody knew you could have an American cook in a little kitchen somewhere, but a great chef in 1978, which is when this happened, or actually 1979, a great chef was by definition a European. And suddenly people had Alice's, oh, she grilled lamb in Central Park, which is illegal. It was illegal then, it's illegal now, but she did it. So people walking by were getting the scent of lamb right mm-hmm. off the grill. But it just, people were absolutely electrified by the fact that the American chefs were just as good as the Europeans. Mm-hmm. Paul Prudhomme served things people had never had until then.
Blackened redfish.
Nobody. He served, as I remember, seafood sausage. Nobody had had seafood sausage.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Didn't exist. And, for example, he served seafood or fish, I think, with a sauce that was constructed on a meat essence. Nobody'd ever had a meat sauce on fish or a fish sauce on meat. That sort of thing was just not done. Everything was very inventive, and people were blown away. And by chance, I believe, and I'm not entirely certain, but by chance, I think that was the week that the Washington Post was launching its food section.
Hmm.
That's another thing. Food sections were suddenly popping up all over the country. And they wrote about our event. And it really made a huge historic difference.
Hmm.
Well, one thing that event did, aside from launching Alice Waters and Chez Panisse, but it launched a really nationwide craze for Cajun food.
Oh,
that was one of the first ethnic cuisines that really sparked people's interests and got them excited about trying new flavors.
Absolutely.
And I can remember when Paul Prudhomme opened his restaurant just for a short time in New York. It was sort of almost like a pop-up restaurant. Remember?
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
And people would line up for hours and hours to wait for a seat at like a big picnic table. It was just all big trestle tables. With anybody who was there.
I think it was the first pop-up restaurant ever.
Yeah.
Actually. Mm.
And it lasted for only a few months, right?
Yes.
It just, it was too much for him, or?
Well, you know, he had his team. And I don't know if he was ever able, or if he even wanted to create a real team in New York. Mm-hmm. But his team went back to
New Orleans, yeah.
Is Paul still alive?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. My goodness, yes.
And he's lost a lot of weight. Is that true, or?
I haven't heard
that. At one point, he lost quite a lot of weight.
I hope he had a bypass.
And he's had an accident hurting his foot, so that he's in a wheelchair a lot of the time.
Mm.
Very well. I mean, I gotta ask this question. I mean, this is kind of the stuff that most excited me. I mean, now we're talking about this kind of history. So, on the town in New York from 1776 to the present, must have been fascinating research. And I just was wondering, and this is kind of like a personal interest of mine, but if you could just speak really briefly to, you know, the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries and what some of the milestones were in each century in terms of New York and therefore American cuisine and relationship to food.
Well, starting with the 18th century, New York was, it was always, in a way, had the greatest variety of people, the most open city in the colonies. And people tended to convene in taverns. Taverns were what we now, both restaurant and hotel. In the 18th century, taverns filled those requirements. And you could have a side of beef, something on that order. And the thing is, taverns served a lot of liquor. And it must be said, the 18th century was a heavy drinking period. Mm. And New York was a heavy drinking town. Mostly people were drinking fortified wines, Madeira, or rum.
Made here? I mean, not the rum, but
the
I mean,
ships would come in laden down with liquid.
Well, yeah. Wasn't it part of the slave triangle? The rum, sugar, slaves,
cotton.
Going back and forth to the
Caribbean trade,
islands. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but an awful lot of liquor arrived all up and down the eastern seaboard by boat. It came. We didn't make anything here at that time, although I have to say, Jefferson at one point tried to grow grapes for wine.
Right.
He tried everything from an agricultural point of view that you can imagine even today. But we didn't produce any of our own wine. Well, I guess there was moonshine.
We had cider.
Moonshine,
yeah.
Well, we produced cider here.
Yeah, and
people
cider.
Drank a lot of cider.
And was the food good at any of these places? Was there any attention towards gastronomy or trying to be a culinary capital?
Not really. What people ate were sides of meat. And don't forget, meat was much more plentiful here than it was in Europe. That was one of the reasons people came here. Food was cheap and plentiful, and it really was. So you'd have a side of lamb or side of beef or whatever. It could be venison over the fire. But cooking was very basic in those days in the inns. Mind you, in people's homes, there was great cuisine. People are wrong in thinking that the Puritans were not interested in food or were puritanical about food. In fact, great food was meant to be your reward for good behavior.
Hmm.
It was the white bread of God. The white and people don't know. Mrs. Oliver Cromwell wrote a cookbook, and the most modest recipes in it had 19 different spices.
Hmm.
So there was always great cooking at home, but it did not translate to taverns, which were very simple and basically drinking places, or there would be dances, there would be sort of very simple social events in the long room, usually above the tavern restaurant. But it wasn't until the 19th century that things really became exciting.
Well, at least you've enlightened me to know now the period that Katie would have most liked to return to would have
Absolutely.
The drinking tavern. Yeah. No, just kidding. But so tell us about the 19th century.
Maybe. Well, two enormous, enormous things emerged in the 19th century. One was the restaurant as we know it today, and the other was the hotel as we know it today. Mm.
So well, let's take a break because we're at our 20th minute, and we're going to come back on that very interesting thing. We're going to learn about the history of restaurants in America and also hotel culture, and where did it begin and where is it now?
With our guest, Ariane Batterbury.
Good. I'll never know why you tell me goodbye and leave me so lonely and blue. For you should have no reason to go, for darling, I've always been true. Tell me, why would you desert me the way you're doing tonight? Why would you want to hurt me, darling?
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back. Our guest in the studio today is Ariane Batterbury. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with Patrick Martins.
And we are talking about hotels and restaurants, both being born in 19th century New York. So we'll pick up on that. So tell us about the major milestones of 19th century gastronomy in America.
Well, now I wouldn't, not to correct you, but I would say they were both born in the 19th century, not necessarily in New York, but they certainly flowered in New York more than any other city in the country.
I'm born and raised in New York, so I'm always trying to get us extra attention. Sorry.
Well, to begin with, both were products of the French Revolution and the democratizing of the world. The hotel was a product of the French Revolution because suddenly it was conceived that a commoner, somebody who didn't have great wealth, might want to stay when he traveled in the equivalent of a palace. In other words, the hotel provided a way to buy the palace life, the life of an aristocrat, by the day. A completely modern concept, just as ready-to-wear clothing. Suddenly, there was the idea you could dress like a princess, or you could dress like a member of the aristocracy, by buying clothes that were made in advance and then just fitted to you last minute. So the whole idea, it was all the result of the mindset of the French Revolution, was to make the luxurious life available to everybody, even if it wasn't full-time. Now, in the United States, the first big luxury hotel was the Tremont, I believe, in Boston. But the idea spread very quickly to New York, And one reason the names of so many hotels have palace in them was because of this concept. Hmm. And the first hotels in New York were large buildings where you could rent a room, a really beautifully decorated or somewhat decorated room, not like the old inns where there was one room for all the men to sleep in, one room for all the women, and one crib in case there was a traveling child. No. Hmm. No, now you had private rooms. You didn't quite yet have elevators, but those were pioneered in hotels later in the century. But one distinguishing feature about the 19th century hotel, and they grew very large very quickly. They went from being 15 or 20 rooms to being 50 rooms quite rapidly. One thing, though, that would be unfamiliar to people today is the fact that people dined at communal tables in hotels. Now, hotels were particularly caught on in the United States because we were where everybody was moving all the time. People would go to the frontier, then they'd come back to the big cities, then they'd go back to the frontier. They'd go develop something, bring it to the city to sell, or they'd make a killing on their fruits or vegetables in the fall and have a little extra money. So they'd want to go into the city, see other people. And this idea of the communal table was a great social factor.
Just the people from the hotel or yes. from outside as well?
No, basically it was the people from the hotel. Mm-hmm. And the idea, and when it was proposed that people have their own private tables, which happened around 1860, there was a lot of outrage. And journalists said things like, why would anybody go to a hotel but for the pleasure of being able to dine with similar people they didn't know? Network, in other words, rather than sitting alone at your own table. A lot of the travelers were on their own also. Families didn't travel nearly as much, so people just loved the communal tables. But as the concept of luxury grew, the idea of having your own table became conceived as a luxury. And in the hotels, there began to be a concentration on food and the excellence of food. Hmm. And don't forget, a lot of the great chefs who had worked for the great titled houses in France, especially, suddenly were out of work. Their employers had their heads cut off very often, or they had fled to England, mm-hmm. or even the United States.
Or they just lost their estates.
Or they'd lost their estate. So there are a lot of out of work chefs,
yeah. And hotels were kind of a place for them to end up.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. Now, I wonder, these hotels... how expensive were they? I mean, could a common person afford such a thing? Or, I mean, was it...
Well, the idea was that the common man, not an impoverished person, not that there were many of those in the United States at that time, but the common man who had a decent living could go 2 or 3 days in a hotel just to have an exciting trip, perhaps to New York, or to Boston, or to Philadelphia. So the idea was, for a little money, you bought the ability to be a prince for a few days. Mm-hmm. Now, restaurants had a similar development. Again, chefs who were put out of work in the early 19th century, late 18th century, actually, in France, began to open up little places where they served or provided basically takeout food. And then they began to serve things like pates, ice cream, which was a new development, things of that sort.
That you could eat there.
Yes, they were called traiteurs, that you could eat there, but you could take them out. Mm-hmm. And from that, the restaurant developed.
Yeah.
Now, I was going to say the restaurant in New York had a really interesting development because there was a huge, huge celebration for the return of, excuse me, 1 minute.
Yeah.
The return of Lafayette, who came back to the United States, I think, in 1831 as an old man.
After having helped America win the Revolution.
That's right.
And it was a very touching story because when he was on the boat, he was penniless. And when he was on the boat coming to the United States, he was afraid he wouldn't be able to afford staying in the country long. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a fellow traveler offered him his house in Boston for the duration so that he would have some place to stay. What he didn't know was that 100,000 people, maybe the largest congregation of people in one place at one time in the world at that time, were waiting in New York Harbor to greet him.
Oh, I have goosebumps, Ariane. That
yes,
is so
it gives
lovely.
You goosebumps. And when he arrived, he looked around, and the country had developed so, and there were great equipages, beautiful carriages, women in gorgeous dresses, men, again, very beautifully arrayed. Everything looked very wealthy, and he couldn't. He was totally disoriented, you would say now.
Mm.
And he turned to a friend who he'd made on the boat and said, "But where are the people?" Capital T, capital P.
Yeah.
The people for whom he created a revolution, they'd suddenly become wealthy. He couldn't understand that at all. But he was entertained and there was arrived at roughly the same time a Swiss sea captain, which I know sounds like a contradiction in terms.
Yes.
His name was Delmonico. And he realized that there were 100,000 people milling around the streets of New York and not a single restaurant or restaurateur, which is, as I was saying, what already existed and had developed in France specifically. So he founded Delmonico's.
Was that the first restaurant then, you could say?
The first thing you would really, really call a restaurant in New York.
Where was it located? Way downtown, no? I would imagine.
It was located way, way downtown. Mm. And it expanded, and within 10 or 15 years, it had 40 or 50 offerings, and people came beautifully dressed to have dinner. This was by the middle of the 19th century, the restaurant really existed, and by the end it had of the 19th century, the lobster palaces, you know, it had become the social center, the social centers for New York.
Fascinating. Ariane,
wow.
You are fabulous.
Well, I mean, we're going to keep on going because, I mean, we should really, you should have your own show. But tell us now, this is, I have a million questions right on that, but I mean, because we only have like 10, 15 more minutes, tell us then in the 20th century, what happened? Is it with all the immigration and all the technology? I mean, how did that affect food?
Well, there have been huge, huge things happening in the 20th century. At the beginning of the century, restaurants were doing very well, and they were proliferating all over New York. As I said, the lobster palaces were the places everybody went near Broadway, and the big stars would make their entrances after the show, and people would spend fortunes on great luxurious food.
Which would be what then? Oysters and lobsters and
whatever is luxurious today, they had
then.
They
had then, okay.
But suddenly came Prohibition, which killed the restaurant industry, because restaurateurs, going right back to the 18th century, had always made their money off of wine and spirits. Mm-hmm. And
it's the first time I've ever heard anyone say that. Everyone says how it kills cocktail culture, of course, but it killed the restaurant industry,
makes
too.
Makes total sense,
of course, yeah.
It really, really, restaurants folded right and left. Speakeasies open, and you had to know who they, you know, you had to have a password, you had to get in, it was...
Did they sell food in speakeasies?
Oh,
no.
Yes.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
And was it good?
Oh, yes, the 21 Club was originated in a speakeasy. But it was a big, big setback. Mm-hmm. Big setback. But after the right to serve wine and spirits was restored in the 30s, restaurants started to develop again. Of course, they had another setback with the Second World War. Mm-hmm. When people were concentrating on more serious things.
And also there was rationing.
There was rationing. But something important happened in New York, which was that the French Pavilion at the World's Fair in 1939 served wonderful food. And the people who prepared the food at the French Pavilion did not go home because war had broken out. Mm. So they stayed in New York, and the Pavillon restaurant was open, and the chefs that trained there opened restaurants all over the city.
So what were some of those big ones in the late, or in the 40s and early 50s?
Well, as I was saying before, the Pavillon, which was named after the French Pavilion, the Colony, which was in the East 60s, and where Cirio Maccione was the maître d',
who ultimately opened
the Cirque and became one of the most famous restaurateurs in the United States. After the war, there really was a blossoming, but the food was not all that great. Mm-hmm. American food tended towards the bland. Steakhouses had great steaks, always. That was the great American tradition. Mm-hmm. And fish seafood houses had very simple seafood, but good, because the product was excellent. But it wasn't really until the great burgeoning of the interest in food in the late 70s that food in the United States grew by leaps and bounds, mm-hmm. in terms of taste and quality and so on. And that, when we founded Food and Wine, happily we were riding that wave.
Yes, exactly.
And we were able to report it, and I think to make it national.
Now, how would you think the next chapter, if you were to add another section to this book, what would it look like? I mean, as you look from 2010 and beyond, what do you see? I mean, what transformations in the industry have you most enjoyed experiencing?
Now, it's hard to say. I have to say the industry had another one of its setbacks in 2008. But the restaurant industry recovered more quickly than any of the other industries. Really, it recovered very rapidly, so that by 2010, credit card chits in restaurants had went up 9.5%. And there was, restaurants came back as healthy as before. One thing that hasn't happened, you asked me earlier about trends. I think there's been a lack of clear trends right now because of the recovery. Because in a recovery, nobody wants to take chances on something more or less unusual. There are a few mini trends, for example, mussels. Restaurants with big mussel menus are suddenly all over the place. And that's terrific, but that's a mini trend. Mm-hmm. In terms of huge trends that affect the whole industry, we have to look and see what happens in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
I'd say one of the huge trends that's happening in fine dining, though, is certainly the resurgence of interest in meat, in proteins, and especially in heritage breeds.
I would say, to me, the biggest trend is learning how to do haute cuisine, French cuisine, pre the order. So you can make all the great food, and I know this is a David Chang thing, which I'm going to mention now. Christina is going to be our next guest, but of doing the prep work so that the actual execution of it, the trigger of it, is very quick. So all of a sudden, you, by prepping all this food early on, you can go to Mama Fuku Sambar or many of these Teresi restaurant, and they've done all this prep before, so that you're actually eating very quote-unquote high-end, high-technique food a la minute.
By the way, I should say very quickly, because it's not a recent trend, it's a huge groundswell. concentration on the quality of the produce and that it should be local if it can be is more than a trend. It's
a movement.
It's a huge movement, like the invention of the restaurant itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's become so basic, and diners in restaurants and hotels and so on are no longer willing to accept second-rate ingredients in mm-hmm. the food they eat.
Well, fascinating. I mean, I'm going to still push through a couple of last-minute questions that total non-sequiturs at this point. How did the powers in the publishing world embrace the idea of you and Michael coming with food magazines? I mean, had there been other food magazines before you?
Well, there was Gourmet, which was founded in 1940. We founded Food and Wine in 1978.
Okay.
And we realized that huge things were happening in food. And one of the things we realized was that men were as interested in preparing food as women.
49% of your reader base was men, right?
Absolutely. Just like 49% of the population was male. And that was earth-shaking because Gourmet was always a woman's magazine. There was never any question. But we created a magazine specifically to appeal to both. We didn't have, when we showed a dish, we didn't have it with a little lace napkin. And so we would show it in a more abstract way so that men wouldn't be put off by a food magazine.
Oh, interesting. So just the art direction was really part of the thing that really sold the magazine through to the male population. That's fascinating. Yes.
Like what, for instance? Like cartoons or like no, what like, you guys like to see?
Well, it would be
see?
Like putting the ingredients next to the dish instead
well,
of having
exactly.
it set.
For example, we'd have a lemon dessert, and instead of serving it in a little dish, as I said, a little napkin and so on, we'd have 1,000 lemons disappearing into the distance and a sunrise, which was in fact a lemon. Dessert.
Yeah,
I like that.
I mean, because I grew up reading Gourmet magazine. My mother and father were both really interested in cooking, but you're right. My father never looked at the magazine. My mother was the only one, and it was always very fussy looking photography,
yeah.
especially in the early days.
Do you read? What are some of the magazines or examples of food journalism that you most look to for inspiration when coming up with the new issue of Food Arts?
Oh, we don't look anywhere else. Others look to us.
Others look to you. Good answer. Now I have something who you can give advice to, 15-year-old kids or 17-year-old kids, and someone who's like grows up in Iowa or an inner city Detroit, and they say, I want to get into food. I want to be a chef. I want to make a difference in gastronomy. What advice would you give those children from your years of experience?
Well, if you can afford it, I have to say there are great schools out there, and they're all over the country. And, of course, there are the leading schools like the CIA.
French Culinary.
And the FCI, the French mm-hmm. Culinary, and ICE, and
Johnson
and Wales. There are those, the great ones, that are mm-hmm. very well known. But there are a lot all over the country, and you just have to find them and see if you can't afford them,
mm-hmm.
if you really, really cannot afford a school or the time to go to a school, you have to be earning money. I would say find a good chef and say, I want to be your apprentice, the old way. There are still great chefs who come up the old way.
Mm-hmm. And tell me real quickly, last question I have before we wrap up, but James Beard, Julia Childs, were these people inspirations to you? I mean, did you study with them or live with them or
well,
write about them?
I knew them both very, very well.
Right.
And of course, they both would be an inspiration to anyone. And they were delightful, charming people. Both of them had a great sense of humor. They were wonderful.
Fantastic.
What
well, Katie,
what
do we do?
Fantastic career.
I mean, we should have had three hours.
You're
on
a tough
this.
Act to follow, Ariane Batterbury.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back in a couple of minutes with our next guest, so please stay tuned. Welcome back to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the studios of the network at Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. Brunch is being served. Our sponsor today is Fairway Market, and our next guest in the studio is the wonderful Christina Tosi, who is the genius behind the dessert menus for David Chang's restaurants, the Momofuku. What do you call it? An empire at this point. I mean, it just keeps expanding and expanding. So welcome to the show, Christina. And you were just saying you were going to come last week, and then instead you were opening up yet another new location. So why don't we start by talking about that? And then we can go into the madness and the genius behind the Tosi touch of restaurant of desserts.
Great. Thanks for having
me. Oh, it's a great pleasure, really.
I'm sorry I couldn't make it last week. We moved our kitchen to Williamsburg on Metropolitan between Marcy and Havemeyer about a year ago because we were doing all the baking in the East Village in a very, very tiny kitchen. And after doing it, 24 hours, just nonstop on a rolling production, we literally had no room. So we found a great space. We moved our kitchen and we just opened a storefront so everyone can come and get a cookie.
They don't have
to go all the way to Manhattan
anymore. If you did not have enough production already on your shoulders. You're supplying a storefront as well. That's amazing.
Desserts can be transported like that. I mean, there are no desserts that cannot survive transport.
No.
Like I'm thinking of like Ariane Battenberg was just here. So souffles or something. There's nothing that's sensitive to.
We have tried to master the composition of desserts where we never. Anything that needs that like delicate finishing touch happens at the location where it's being served.
That makes sense. Yeah.
We try and put as much care into the production part of it, and we try and be as smart as possible so that nothing tips over in transit.
And you do desserts for Momofuku, Noodle Bar, Sambar, Mapesh.
Yeah.
And
all the milk bars.
And all the milk bars.
Yeah, we used to do it for Co as well, but they have taken... they've really taken a great interest in desserts, so they do a lot of their production.
They took bit into their teeth.
No, it's great. Savory cooks are always a little timid about making desserts, but once you get on a roll, I think if you have a passion for food,
why wouldn't you want to? Actually, if you're the one who's figuring out the savory part of the menu, I think you'd want to find desserts that really sort of fit into your vision of what's on the savory side. Christina, I'm going to read a little bit about your bio because you really have a really funny backstory. So you started at WD-50, right? So you were with Wiley Dufresne, who I think everybody who listens to this show probably knows is one of the most innovative chefs.
He's been on before. It was a great show.
He's an extraordinary presence in the food world. But not only that, you also know how to write a HACCP plan, which I thought was just a fascinating part of your story. And HACCP, in case people don't know, is hazardous analysis and critical control points, I think, right? So it's people are, you're looking at ways in which foodborne pathogens can enter the supply stream.
Exactly.
And thus poison.
I'm impressed.
Basically making it legal to serve something.
Yeah, exactly. You won't be serving any sprouts anytime soon, I hope.
No, I'm going to steer clear.
Oh, why? What's that? What happened there?
You have not been following the story of this incredible E. coli outbreak in Germany that killed 39 people.
Where they blamed the Spaniards.
Cucumbers and caused them millions of dollars in financial loss. And then it turned out that actually it was an organic sprout farm near Hamburg, which was responsible for this.
Germans could do something weird and
I'm going to be doing a news drop about this later in the week, but there was so much, there were so many clues pointing to exactly where this was coming from, and the Germans just did not want to have any part of the idea that this might have actually originated in their own country, hence the finger pointing at virtually every other EU country on the slate. So you know how to write a HACCP plan. Why is that? You have to study up for that.
I think I taught myself, but I think it's probably because I'm a lot of a nerd.
She's a nerd.
I was raised to kind of be a bookworm, an overachieving bookworm. But I was a pastry cook at WD-50 for Wiley and under Sam Mason, and once you kind of get the rhythm of the kitchen, they just raise you. I mean, I was raised as a child to be an overachiever, and then once you kind of get in that kitchen, they really raise you to push yourself on any different level. And we were having issues with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene because we were using a cryovac machine, which is a machine that kind of creates an altered atmosphere in a bag.
Ooh, so it might be an adulteration.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Was that
for doing sous vide?
Yeah, it was for cooking sous vide. It was also just for compressing fruits or vegetables or meats with anything to kind of infuse flavors or juices or spices. And the health department wasn't really sure. They knew that it was unsafe, but they weren't really sure why it was unsafe. So it was kind of, everyone had to kind of start from square one. They knew they wanted to demand this plan, but nobody really had any other direction other than that. So it was a really great opportunity to just kind of make it this learning thing for everybody. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
So you were doing this to defend taste. You would say, I need to create this taste. This is the only way to do it. So let me prove that it's okay.
Yeah.
And that people won't get sick from it.
Exactly. I think I was doing it to defend Wiley and WD-50 and doing it to defend food. Yeah, of course, because people do it in all over the United States, of course. It's a very common technique that's used in European cuisines.
So what did you do? You read books? I mean, what would you teach someone if they're in Cleveland, in the suburbs or in the middle of Kansas and saying, hey, I want to do this thing that I tasted in New York? I mean, is it befriending your local inspector as well?
It is all of those things. It is getting on the internet and kind of trying to be as much of a sponge as possible and doing as much research as possible, befriending your local health department, and just kind of digging as much as you can, reading. At that time, there wasn't a ton of published literature in English, which is also why it was so difficult, because the health department will honor a variety of things as long as it's published scientific data in English, and it just didn't exist. So you had to really get your nerd on. I went to college, but I definitely did not major in science or chemistry. I really didn't relate to those things at all. But I think once I kind of developed a passion for food, passion,
it becomes interesting to do the studying, right?
Yeah. So. I mean, once you learn what the technique can do to food, you really want to fight to defend it because it really has amazing.
And you use it a lot in making desserts?
We have a cryovac machine in our kitchen. We use it for really basic things. I think the one thing about a cryovac machine is once you get your nerd on and you write this hazard analysis plan, you do realize really how you could harm somebody. So you don't want to just give it to a kitchen of kids that aren't going to be trained 100% on it, and you certainly don't want them to like use techniques that they just kind of saw in a magazine or what have you. So we use it for pretty basic things, for pretty basic like steeping coffee grounds in milk, cold steeping coffee grounds in milk. We use it for just quick pickling, things that are really safe that can't harm anybody, and also just because it's a really good introduction for why you would use a cryovac.
Now, you have a celebrated sweet tooth. I mean, yes. I forget who I was talking to about you the other night, but they were like, oh yeah,
it's bad.
Crack pie. Now, I picked a couple of names of desserts off of the menu just because I thought they were so funny. Crack pie, of course. And then I read a recipe for that, which just...
Wait, what is crack pie? Let's hear, because that's really a famous one.
Yeah, that's your... I think that's your signature dish, right?
I have a friend that flies
dish, right?
in from Atlanta just to get Christina's crack pie. It's crazy.
I mean, that is just so funny to me because it was just kind of like this sugar pie that I made one day.
Well, a sugar pie, Christina. Don't you think that's a little crazy?
Well, but it's not. I mean, like, it just seems so obvious. Like, if you like sugar, when you want sugar, what you're really looking for is something that is just, like, sweet and gooey and everything just satisfying. So this pie we make, like, a salty oat cookie. And then we mush it down into the pie tin to make a crust. And then the filling, we call it a gooey butter filling, but that's just to kind of give a description that your average person would be able to wrap their head around. But it's really just, it's all of the fillings of a pie minus the actual flavor, whether it's like berries or chocolate or what have you. So it's sugar, butter, egg yolks, heavy cream, vanilla.
Is sugar always the component?
How many different kinds of sugar do you use?
Is sugar a component to all the desserts? Because I know there's molasses, there's maple syrup, there's sorghum. Like, is sugar... Because I read this book, Sugar as Power. It was written by Mintz or something like that. A very powerful book about the importance of sugar throughout history. So, I mean, tell me, is sugar just everywhere and everything in a dessert kitchen?
I think... sugar is typically in every recipe in a variety of ways, whether it's honey, whether it's light brown sugar, dark brown sugar, glucose, just your average granulated sugar. But we use sugar for flavoring, just like you would use salt, or and there's a ton of different salts, or pepper, and there's or a spice. But we usually, I think, I've never been asked that before, but I think we probably have just like your average granulated sugar in like 99% of our recipes. But a lot of times we have a variety of different sugars because they all provide different sweetness, different flavors while imparting the sweetness.
Do you infuse your sugars like with vanilla bean? I mean, are there other methods of infusing sugar besides using a half a vanilla bean in your, you know, in your container, which I do a lot.
Yeah, we... I would say we use sugar as a seasoning just like we use salt or pepper. I think the one thing about our desserts is most people think like, oh, it's crack pot. There's this thing called crack pie, so everything is going to be like sickeningly sweet when it's really not. We use it. I kind of look at using sugar as a seasoning just like you would anything else. So I don't ever make like a flavored sugar. I just make something that tastes the way that I want it to taste, and then I use whatever kind of means and ingredients necessary to achieve the flavor, whether it's as simple as banana or as complicated as cereal milk.
Well, okay, thank you for bringing up cereal milk, because I was reading an interview up front with you, and you were saying that the only way you would ever drink milk is if you had had like 3 or 4 bowls of cereal in it first, and then first you eat the cereal, and then you drink the milk, because it was so highly sweetened by that time. And so now you actually use that as a component in your desserts.
Yeah.
So what's that process?
Our cereal milk, it's like the same thing as crack pie, where it's just kind of like, oh, we are kind of just joking, but not really. We just take cornflakes, we roast them in the oven. A lot of times when you're steeping a flavor into any sort of liquid, you typically toast it to deepen the flavor when it steeps.
Frosted flakes?
We use cornflakes.
Cornflakes,
we just use your average
Kellogg's. But those don't have sugar on them.
They don't. Because it's not... The cereal milk is not sweet. It has a little bit of light brown sugar in it to give a depth of flavor, but it's not about it being sweet. It's about
it. It's the corn?
So we take these cornflakes, we roast them in the oven, we grind them down into like a powder, we steep them in milk. We let them sit for about 20 minutes to really impart the flavor, just like you would when you're eating a bowl of cereal. We strain them out, and then we season the milk with a little bit of light brown sugar and a little bit of corn powder, because it just kind of and a little bit of salt, and it just kind of balances and accentuates the flavor. The trick to it is trying to get it to taste like it's a few different cereals, depending on what your favorite cereal is.
Well, yeah, I have Apple Jacks right now. My favorite cereal, just for the thing. I mean, I think Captain Crunch has got to be it. But
Golden Grahams for me are pretty big. I just kind of like ate the last part of a stale box of Golden Grahams the other night.
I'm not proud to say this, but Lucky Charms.
Oh, so good.
And they would always add a new marshmallow. I think Green Diamonds was like the newest one at a certain
time. No, sorry. The green was always the four-leaf clover.
So then it was Blue Horseshoe.
The Blue Horseshoe, I think. And there was like a purple unicorn there or something.
Pink stars.
I
have to go to the Kellogg's Lucky Charm Leprechaun outfit.
So it's so brilliant. So it's just basically calling. I mean, would that be what you would say is like trying to recreate these epiphanies of childhood, like as an adult?
It's so funny.
Because it has that effect.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so funny because when cereal milk came along, I was kind of just standing in the kitchen by myself trying to figure out what to make. I had made a few desserts for Sambar, and I had a little soft serve program going at Noodle Bar, and we were about to open Co. This was probably 3 years ago, and it by no means was intentional. I think for me, my strategy was I'm in trouble. We're opening this tasting menu only restaurant. Dave's got, like, when you have serious hype, which I think Dave did then and probably still does, you have a huge target on your back. So if you work for a man that has a huge hype, you know that everything is going to be highly scrutinized. And I thought, well, now I have this target. We have this target on our back, and we have this tasting menu only restaurant. So no one's going to choose what they want. You have to give them some, you have to make something that is going to appease to everybody that sits down. And not only that, but when you have that many courses of dinner, no one remembers dessert. Like, let's be real. Mm-hmm. Everyone remembers, like, their favorite somewhere in the beginning or the middle. Maybe you remember, like, your big meat course if it's really special, but you rarely remember dessert because you're stuffed, because X, Y, and Z. And how do I make something that is just clever enough that somebody remembers it, or that they can relate to just enough that they remember it? How do you give people something different that they'll remember without making it seem so out of the box or so, you know, out there? Because that's not the intention of dessert. You're not trying to, like, steamroll or upshow anybody. And I was really into steeped milks. We used to do it a lot at WD50, and it was always kind of like, how do you get the, at WD50, I feel like the menu is so, like, cleverly, obviously unobvious, and that's kind of what's so fun about eating there.
Well, and I have a question. It's interesting that you said that the dessert is the thing that people least remember, because you would think by being the last thing, you know, and being sweet, that it would be the things that people most remember.
Yeah, I think
so,
a lot of people
do remember.
I mean, Michael Lyskonas was a guest on the show, remember? And he was like, yeah, I mean, we're the end of the meal, so we have to do something pretty great.
But that you said that, it was very interesting. So where does the pastry chef fit in? You know, and I asked that from the dynamic of the kitchen itself. Now, I know you have your own space, but, like, in this pirate ship atmosphere that is a kitchen, you seem to have, like, the goalie in soccer or the drummer in a band, a kind of independent orbit.
Maybe, like, the last course maybe is less what people remember, but it's like you have to really hit it out of the park because it is that last thing. And on a tasting menu, if it's not a home run, no one's going to remember it because they've had so many courses. I think Michael Lyskonas, when he makes a dessert, it's a home run every time, and so he really fulfills his end of the bargain. Every kitchen that has a pastry department is different. Some of them are really closely tied to the savory menu, some of them aren't. I think for me, my strategy and approach was always, okay, I'm coming into these kitchens to make dessert, and the savory menu existed long before the dessert menu, so I have to make something that complements the food without being too obvious. And there, it was kind of like, there's this world available for desserts, but at the same time, these restaurants weren't made to serve dessert. That was never their original intention. So for me, we don't work service. We don't have enough employees to have pastry cooks working service at every restaurant. So it was very much playing into, how do I really relate to a kitchen that is 95, sometimes 99% men? How do you give them a dessert that they want to stand behind and put the care into and that they can relate to? So I think for me, it was really studying the savory menu and knowing what was going on the savory menu and flavors that they're working with, or even just something like at Momofuku, typically when you get a dish, no matter what Momofuku you're at, you're getting something that's loud. It's very rarely delicate or soft in flavor. So you have to come up with these desserts that are loud, or if they're loud, they're also refreshing or what have you. And it's got to be something that these guys that are just pounding out service can also serve. So our pastry kitchen is really different because we don't work service. We are making desserts that we need to convince this other crew of savory cooks to really stand behind and want to serve.
Very interesting. So yeah, it's very different. Yeah, I mean, that is different.
It's totally different than any pastry kitchen that I've worked in. But Dave also makes a huge point of making sure that everybody knows what's in the works in each other's kitchens. And we have email addresses that go to everybody that is in charge of a kitchen that says, this is what I'm working on, or these are the flavors that I'm working on, or what have you, so that everyone can really stay on the same page. Because otherwise, you can't create something that complements it. And then it seems like this kind of broken piece of the menu at the end, mm-hmm. or an afterthought. And I think that's the tricky part of desserts, is making it not seem like an afterthought.
Who was that great pastry chef who lives in the Hamptons now, who maybe started Gramercy Tavern?
Claudia Fleming.
Oh, Claudia Fleming.
Yeah.
She was talked about. She did. She called in afterwards. There were a few pastry chefs. The pastry chef from Babbo.
Yeah, Gina.
Gina De Palma.
Gina talked De Palma, so highly of this wonderful. Claudia that we had a call in with Claudia. And
she's like everyone's here. I mean, she's not here.
Yeah. So how did she inspire? I mean, like, what, tell us just if you could briefly, and then I want to ask you about technology in the kitchen and like Dave and Wiley's and Dave Arnold's, kind of fascination with technology. But tell us, what were the breakthroughs in dessert culture as you see them? You know, your heroes or things that had never been done before?
Yeah, I think I was never raised in a food world. I was a very, very picky eater until I was in my early 20s or maybe late teens. So for me, as soon as I started really discovering my passion for it, beyond just being a home baker, Claudia Fleming was at the forefront of it all. And she was really, she was making dessert that stood out, and that was that memorable end course of a meal. It wasn't an afterthought. It was more than just a chocolate souffle, and she kind of broke that barrier beyond what you're, at least in, certainly just in sort of New York City and American dining, what that you could get dessert that was more, that had more of a point of view than just your average, you know, like chocolate, lemon, right. vanilla, you know, kind of your staples. You had to have a creme brulee on the menu or what have you. And she was really starting to push it in American and at least like Northeastern dining, where for someone like me, I grew up in Virginia, I had access to that and I saw it happening and it was so interesting.
Where in Virginia you grew up?
I grew up in Northern Virginia, just outside of D.C.
Okay, Alexandria kind of zone.
Yeah. So that for me was huge. And then of course, the more you get into what other pastry chefs and other savory cooks are doing, Albert Adria you're crazy if he is not anything but inspiring.
Was that like Ferran Adria's
brother?
Yeah, it's
his really? Brother who yeah. was the pastry chef at Ubuyi for many, many years. And for me, I think the sad part that I always kind of lament on was that I didn't get into that dorky, nerdy part of food earlier. I was like so busy being a dorky nerd and like math.
You were born too late. You should see that Woody Allen film where the guy goes back in time. Woody Allen has this film now where this writer goes back and meets all these old guys like Hemingway. And so it'd be interesting to do that movie through the lens of a pastry chef who would go back and see all these.
It would be, yeah. So I'm saying that. So when you, when somebody brings in a new piece of equipment or something like that, or do you look for a specific equipment that's going to answer to a concept that you have? I mean, are you married to that sort of, gadget geekery that these guys are, or do you stay with kind of like basic techniques and just bring your own special
like mortar and pestle
weird,
and fire, like you,
super nerdy? Yeah, yes, exactly. You're sort of like interesting.
Like
compost cookies.
Yeah,
hello?
I have a very open mind about that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think because I spent so much time like being raised by Wiley in his kitchen. Mm. But at the same time, I think the thing that people don't maybe pay respect to Wiley about is that he also uses the most basic techniques as well. But it's, I think for me, I was really raised on the theory of everything for a reason, where you're just not using this new piece of equipment or technology just because, one, you can't turn a blind eye. You have to constantly be reading and learning and growing. But when you ultimately make that decision, it has to be for a reason. It has to be because you're getting the best possible product. It can't be because it just makes your life easier. Dumbs it down. I think some people stray away from technology out of fear. I think some people stray away from technology because they want to raise the hardest working kitchen, which both of those things are certainly understandable and honorable in their own way. I love when people that have been classically trained and still work in those classically trained environments get on board with the technology thing and really educate themselves. I'm fortunate enough to work for Dave and for a restaurant group that usually kind of gets their hands on the really cool new things early on to kind of be able to be in the loop. But it takes a lot of effort to educate yourself, and there's always something new going on. And what can I do with it? Does it fit on my menu, or am I just doing it because it's a trend or what have you?
Well, what do you see are the trends right now in dessert
making?
Or
what tools does any good dessert person need, too? I mean,
well, those are two different questions.
Yeah. Okay, I feel like just like from the earlier part of our conversation, where we have this pastry kitchen that is not like any other pastry kitchen for all of the different rules and parameters and reasons, whether it's who we're bringing dessert to or how we're selling it to the masses. I know what my staples are, and they're anything from brand something that's brand new or something that's as sophisticated as a cryovac machine to something that is like as like retro or frowned upon as a microwave, where I'll really like, you know, that breadth of things is really
you
interesting.
You use a microwave?
I love a microwave.
Cut the feed, Jack.
I love a microwave. I want to write a microwave cookbook, but I don't think anyone else is interested in it but me. But for me, the microwave is one of those.
What do you use it for?
I use it to melt everything gently. We use it to poach rhubarb in, because instead of cryovacking rhubarb in a bag with liquid and then putting it in a circulator, which is kind of like a machine that holds a steady temperature in a water bath, if you put rhubarb in this liquid in a container in the microwave and microwave it for 7 minutes, you have a perfect poach. So for me, you're always going to have that balance when new technology comes out, where you're like, you could certainly use it and discover like its breadth of capabilities, but the fun part I think is always figuring out like, oh, I already have this thing in the kitchen that I
and it's
can
really
also,
better
yeah you can make lemon curd in the microwave.
I can't believe you called it retro.
I mean,
the microwave is like, I still think of it as a
most
fairly
of Katie's
new
life
piece
of there
technology.
Wasn't even indoor plumbing, so
yeah. I just turned in like all of the text to our milk bar cookbook.
Oh, yay.
And I wanted to write this like long 2-page thing about like my ode to the microwave, because you can make so many things in it. And they were just like, we're 2 pages too long.
Oh,
it's gotta
get
but
that
I know so it'll come one day.
So I have a question. This might be a stupid question, but do you come up with an idea first and then try to execute it, or do you just try to throw ingredients together kind of like an artist or like Jackson Pollock that would throw all these colors together, or are you more conceptual in advance? I mean, if you could divide yourself into one of those camps.
I would say I'm a little bit of both, but I would say I'm less conceptual. I think always from the beginning when I worked in fancy pastry kitchens, my big fear at WD50 was just like, I don't think I'm ever going to be one of these kinds of pastry chefs. I would die for any of these men that I'm working for, but I don't know that this is really my thing, because I was, you know, raised to approach things in a certain way, and I just thought, well, I don't think that that's my process, so maybe I'm just never going to be a pastry chef, or I'm just never going to make it to that level. Maybe I'll just be a really good pastry cook for the rest of my life. But then I kind of realized that there were a bunch of different ways to go about it. I think flavor is usually a starting point, but at the same time, so many of our things are born off of like happy mistakes and happy accidents, like mismeasuring or accidentally burning something or cooking it too long, and just using that mistake not as a mistake but as a stepping point to get somewhere else, and then either applying another flavor or applying that technique.
Very interesting.
Now, do they not serve your desserts table side, right? I mean, you still, there's this takeout component of that. Is that something that I mean, why was that figured? Is it because
you mean at Milk Bar?
Well, for instance, like at Ma Pesh, there's no dessert at the actual. Is that something because it's its own independent gastronomic category that doesn't have to relate exactly with, or is it for turnover, or like what is that? I've always just been interested and I didn't know the reason.
I think when Ma Pesh was first opening, we knew we wanted to put a milk bar upstairs. And I think we were pretty married to the fact that we had like 5 employees at Milk Bar and we didn't have enough of a staff to make this dessert program. And not only that, but we had this little microcosm of this Momofuku Empire in the East Village, and all of a sudden we were going to be in Midtown. So then we'd have to teach a whole new breed of cooks how to plate desserts, how to make desserts, how to put the finishing touches on them, which most chefs are really controlling, and I certainly fit into that. I'm not one of those. So part of it was that. Part of it was certainly the turn times. You know, the original noodle bar worked because the turns, you could turn and burn those tables and those diners so easily. There actually are a few desserts on the Ma Pesh menu now, and you can get Milk Bar to go. I think Milk Bar had just become so popular that it was just like, what's the harm? Take a cookie to go. I mean, do you really want me to put it on a plate for you? I can, but it's not. It was certainly not meant to be taken as seriously as a dessert that's put on a plate in a restaurant.
It's so funny. I was hoping you'd give a different answer. I hope you were going to use that in medieval culture, which is the culture that I'm most interested in. You know, dessert was always held in a different place. And by the end of a 2.5 hour meal, I'm ready to have a coffee and something, but in a different environment.
In a different room.
Standing, moving, doing something like that. So anyway, well, still a good answer.
Yeah, I think Jose Andres had just opened, when we were just about to open Ma Pesh, Jose Andres had just opened his restaurant in LA where they have a separate dessert room.
Yeah.
And Dave had just gone.
Even if you're
and
standing.
He was, oh, yeah, an and he was idea. So in love with the fact that they would whisk you away from your table and into another room for dessert. And
that's
New
a
Yorkers,
medieval thing. It's a banquet. That's
no
where
idea.
Banquets.
Absolutely.
You would go into the yard and there would be another kind of tower with the table set, and it was where wit and everyone had a few drinks in them, where, you know, you could undo your tie a little bit, where people would go
the
off in the bushes and have some, I mean, it was
loosen
the time
your corset.
Anyway, this has been a fascinating
show. I'm
sorry,
and we
really,
don't have
you
more
should
time
come
with
back
you.
And
I will. Yep.
You
I
know,
live
bring
nearby.
Your crew. Bring your crew, you know.
You would only get that's what she said jokes, like
oh,
every
okay.
4 minutes, but maybe that will be a
better that than
show.
In bed, you know, jokes, just putting in bed at the end
oh,
of
yeah.
the thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, all right. Christina Tosi, thanks so much for coming and joining us today. And folks can sample some of Christina's wares down at the new location. Where is your new store?
382 Metropolitan Avenue.
382 Metropolitan Avenue. Check it out, hipsters.
Thank you very much, and we will be back in 1 minute. Yep.
Welcome back to the main course on Heritage
Radio Network. What an exciting
show. Absolutely. Patrick Martins. Patrick is one of our two hosts. I'm the other one, Katie Heaver.
We're sponsored by Fairway Market.
And we're broadcasting from the back of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. Please come on down and join us. And also the twice-monthly Tiki Disco Bar is happening right now this
pounding
afternoon.
Pounding in the underbelly.
Oh, yeah, baby. It's going to be a hot time. So our guest in studio right now is John Donahue. John is an editor at the New Yorker magazine, and he has recently published a wonderful compilation of essays and stories called Man with a Pan, about guys taking back the kitchen. So welcome, John. Thanks so much for coming.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So how did this collection come about?
Well, when I first became a father about 6 years ago, I started cooking, like crazy. It was a reaction, I think, to the kind of excitement, panic, anxiety of being a new parent. And I looked around at my friends who were also new fathers, and they happened to be doing a lot of cooking. And I became interested in how they managed it. And because I work in publishing, some of those friends happen to be accomplished writers. And I thought, well, let's hear their stories.
Let me just stop you right there and just run down the list of contributors to Man with a Pan, because it's like a who's who of great writers, whether food or otherwise. We have Manny Howard, who we've had on the show and who I absolutely adore and have many mutual friends with.
Did I see Mario Batali in there?
Yes, Mario Batali is in there. Sean Wilsey, who is a nonfiction and fiction writer whose work I admire tremendously and whose work is often seen in the pages of the New Yorker. Jim Harrison, Mark Bittman, Thomas Beller, another fiction writer who's really should have no business writing about food, but there he is. Who else was I? Of course, Peter Kaminsky.
Peter Kaminsky, our friend.
Michael Ruhlman.
So how did you come up with the idea and go to these people, or did you read these people's work and say this idea needs to, you know, come to fruition in a book?
Well, I had the idea that I wanted to hear how different men handled their role in the kitchen, because it's a very varied experience. It's different for everybody, and I thought a great way to approach it would be in an anthology to get all these different voices in it. And then I looked around at the writers I admired and, you know, sort of checked and see if they like to cook, and some of the food writers, some of the fiction writers, and just started talking to them. And I got a great response. That was one of the greatest things about doing the book, is if I just asked some of these writers, they were very enthusiastic about doing it.
What were some of the things that surprised you most about, for instance, like Mario Batali or Mark Bittman? Like, were there things that kind of blew your mind or epiphanies that you had just reading about these men's experiences?
Well, not with Bittman or Batali, because their essays reflect how true to themselves they are. Batali is Batali all the time, and so his kids eat duck testicles, you know, and he's just kind of on 100%. And Mark Bittman's essay was just his personal story, really, about how he started in the kitchen. He was newly married in the 70s, I think, in New Haven, and a little bit lost and driving a cab or something. And then he became a father, and he started cooking, and he hanging out at the fish markets. I think his first book was Fish. And then it all went from there.
Absolutely. Amazing. Well, I was really impressed. And I didn't finish the book yet, but I certainly will, because I've enjoyed so much of what I've read already. But one thing that really really jumped out at me in one of the essays right towards the beginning of the book, I think it was... putting food...
Oh, Jack Hitt.
Jack Hitt, yeah. And he says something about how women... No, wait, where is it? It never occurred to me to learn... He's talking about men being in the kitchen as if they were never in the kitchen before. And my feeling is that traditionally men were cooks. I mean... All the great restaurant cooks. I mean, I guess men didn't cook so much in the home.
Right, that's it.
But it was men who drove culinary and gastronomy in terms of like developing tastes and trends and stuff like that.
Sure,
so I thought it was sort of an interesting comment.
On a professional level, and Jack Hitt's also a Southerner. So I think he's talking about Southern America.
Yes, he was.
So, and that's his experience. He just didn't see any men in the kitchen when he was growing up. And I think... professionally, the men dominate the kitchen.
Although my father was an excellent cook. He was from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And he was a marvelous cook. And it was, I think, ubiquitous in his
standard
culture.
Your father being the standard for all American chefs.
Well, no, I'm just saying in the South. I mean, having grown up in New Orleans, he was certainly not the only guy who came out of the box knowing how to cook.
So what did you ask these guys? So you would say, hey, I'm doing this anthology. I am looking for dot, dot, dot. Did you prompt them in any way? Or?
No, I just let them... have free rein, and they came up with whatever. I mean, we talked about what idea they would do, and Mark Kurlansky is a good example. I approached him, and he said, "Well, this is an interesting project. Let me think about it." And he did, and it occurred to him that in his experience, he had never been involved with a woman who knew how to cook. He's in his 60s now, and he never dated a woman who could cook. He wasn't interested in any woman who could cook. And he thought to himself, well, what does this mean? Does that have any significance? And so that's part of what's in his essay. And he was very intrigued by that and happy to write a piece for the book.
Very interesting. So let's talk for a second about, since you are in the publishing industry, I was curious about... How are you promoting the book? Are you using, I mean, this is completely off the topic of your book, but how are you promoting it? Do you use Facebook and Twitter? Are you like deep into the social media thing, or are you more of an old school?
Well, I straddle both worlds. I have a kind of old school mentality. I did put a book together, mm-hmm. not an iPad
yeah,
app.
Right.
But I'm kind of hindered by that, but I love words. I love books. I love the printed word. But I have a blog. It's called stayatstovedad.com.
Right.
And I blog there. I tweet from Stay at Stove Dad. And I'm on Facebook. And
are you going to be tweeting about this show?
I tweeted while waiting. I said, every time I come here, I'm hungry. It just makes me hungry. Roberta's is...
That's why people come on the show.
I made up a new hashtag. I called it This Place Paradise. Pound, This Place Paradise, I said.
Mm. Very nice.
Nice.
You know, I don't quite understand how hashtags work. And I don't really
understand
how any of the social media works.
Well, I like the idea of it, hash.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, of course, from our point of view, yeah, that's very attractive.
But I do, and the food blogger world, the blogger world's been very supportive. People have been,
really?
I think Serious Eats is doing a giveaway. And there's
great.
Does the New Yorker write about it? Or, I mean, is it, how does it deal with
Isn't
the
that
fact
a conflict?
That you work with them?
Well, the New Yorker has a number of very accomplished and
Indeed,
talented writers and is not... doesn't have a shortage of material to publish. And
so what do you do for them?
I edit the listings. I edit the music listings primarily, and I'm responsible for the second in charge of the for all the listings.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do.
Very
yeah, actually, you and I talked
that?
On the phone when I was promoting MOFAD.
Yes.
The Museum of Food and Drink. Yeah. Right. I made that connection after I, we had set up this interview, and I'm like, oh my God, I talked to that guy.
Right.
So now what is that dynamic? I mean, what type of, we've never had anyone from the New Yorker on, we've had tons of people on, but never anyone from there. What is the energy at that place? Is there a cohesiveness amongst all the sections? Is it a fun place to work? Is it constantly you're dealing with all these intimidatingly important issues and figures and events? Like, what's it like working with them?
It's all of that and more.
Yeah. Do you have to like walk around with your head bowed because you know you're not Seymour Hersh? Or
no, I. You know, it's everybody does their job and they're very good at what they do and it's a wonderful place to work. Everybody's very friendly and helpful and talkative and you know it's
so it's maintained its age old dynamic in the hallways of people like. Drifting in and out of each other's offices and sparring wittily about the latest issues or
I don't have any perspective on it. I work there, so it's like, does the fish know it's wet? You know, it's like
I don't know. I mean, it has such a tradition. It has such a mystique.
Oh, absolutely. Having that position and knowing who to talk to is very helpful in getting writers for the book.
I can imagine.
Because the funny thing about it is, I approached a bunch of writers for the New Yorker, and I thought, oh, I've got to be careful. I'm going to have too many writers from the New Yorker in the book. But as it turns out, I didn't have any.
Well, Sean Wilsey writes sometimes.
Right.
Well, he's not a contributing staff, not a staff writer. Yeah.
So let me ask, is an anthology as simple as asking a bunch of people to write an essay and then putting it in the right order? I mean, I imagine there's a huge challenge to write an introduction that's a cohesive thing through all
the intro is excellent, by the way.
Right? And then also, is there any editing that's done to make
of
it
course,
be
of
part?
Course.
So tell us the art of an anthology, because it's different than just sitting down and writing a book.
Right. It's fun because you get to work with a lot of different little pieces, essentially. And there's a level of editing. You have to be kind of... tactful and careful with different. You want to preserve the different voices that are in the collection, and you've approached different writers for different reasons because of the way they use language or they approach something. And some people are more engaged in the editing process than others, and some people need more editing than others. And that's just, I think, normal distribution of how things break down.
Hmm. And what did you like so much about the intro, Katie?
Because it's got a very warm and charming voice. It's just very, it's a sweet intro and, sort of talking about how you keep a woman happy, after you've had your first baby by actually doing things like the shopping.
And that
marriages will stay together a lot longer if the guy cooks. I thought that was fascinating.
I was hoping that wasn't true.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're screwed, buddy.
Oh, brother.
All marriages are different, but
no, I am a divorcee, and I can tell you that the fact that my husband behaved like a visiting dignitary in the house definitely pissed me off. Okay.
Well, I have a little confession. I feel really silly not realizing how much work it is to have a marriage and kids. You know, it's just an enormous amount of work.
Nobody realizes. Yeah. And if they did, they would never do it.
You would never do it.
Exactly. Absolutely. You'd never have children if you knew how much work
they were.
I mean,
just sheer labor, picking up toys and making sure. Yeah. And it's so banal.
And endless.
It's
and like, this idea of just keeping them in a region of the house that's very safe, like a massive pen, and just letting them basically live
with
there.
With padded walls.
No, yeah, you don't need to do that.
You don't need to do that. You know, the thing is that children are very durable. They're not as fragile as you think, you know. Yeah. Probably keep them away from the bleach, but that's about it.
The bleach, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, keep the drawer under the or the cupboard under the sink locked, and you're all set. Let me ask you one more question about this, because I know we're close to running out of time. But do you think that this this book is representative of a new trend in sort of, you know, male responsibilities? Because, I mean, much has been written about the fact that women continue to shoulder 90% of household chores. And do you think that men coming into the kitchen in greater and greater numbers, which I think is definitely happening, do you see that as kind of a nationwide trend, or is that just sort of limited to people on the coasts who are, you know, really interested in food and like to eat well?
No, I think it's a national trend. I have, mm-hmm. in addition to the pieces by the famous writers, I have interviewed dads all across the country. I have a bond trader in LA, a software engineer in New Orleans, firemen in Brooklyn. I have people all over the country who I've talked to, dads who are cooking for their families. And I think it's very... it's a new trend, absolutely. If you look at younger men, anecdotally, whenever I talk to someone who's... I'm 43, so whenever I talk to someone who's younger than me, typically the guy just cooks, and he's used to cooking. He doesn't have this expectation that a woman's going to cook for him. And it's a way for men to contribute in a way that they haven't before. And if you look at what's happened since the 60s, you know, there's more men cooking now than ever before. Are they doing the majority of the cooking? No, they're not. But where's the trend going? I think the trend is going towards more men cooking, especially if you look at the trend in employment. There's now more women in the workforce than there are men because of the recession. So people have a choice, I think, in the way they live their lives. And I think if you look at this book, Man with a Pan, and you like food, if you like having a good time with your family, you can find a way to do some cooking for your family, and you're going to improve your life.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but do men tend towards different recipes than women?
I think very, very broadly speaking, men tend to prefer to cook than to bake.
It's hard to find
a man who likes to bake. There's always exceptions in the book. I have a writer who used to own a pie company, and he has a good bit of advice if you are a young man and you're interested in, you know, increasing your chances with a given woman, bake her something.
Yeah.
You know, that's a kind of...
Very few girls can resist a home-baked dessert. That's right. Definitely true. John, tell us, because we have to wrap it up now, but tell
where
us
they
where
they can buy it and
where you
and
can buy it, but also
it
when your next... You must have other events scheduled around New York. Do you want to direct people to a reading or some other promotional
device? I don't have anything scheduled for the near term. Mm-hmm. Right now, I did roast a pig last week at Smorgasbord.
Excellent. Oh,
nice. That was...
And did you find your goat, by the way?
Well, I wanted to do a goat roast, but... Couldn't find the goat.
I know, no, it's not so. That easy.
We were shorted a goat the other day for a French Culinary Institute demo. They're hard to find in the season. I don't think they naturally are ready for killing right now.
Well, goats only bear twice a year. Yeah, exactly. It's like cats. So
we did a pig, and it proved to be a smart move because pigs are kind of very easy to cook, and they're a crowd pleaser.
Yeah,
I think if we had announced goat roast, I don't know how many people would have crowded around the table, but when we said pig roast, boy, you want to draw a crowd, put a pig on it, roasted pig on a table, and you'll have a crowd.
Is there a website for this book?
There is stayatstovedad.com has information about it. And it's on Amazon. It's in all the independent bookstores around New York. Have been great. They have it out on the shelf. They have it out on the table. I've seen it on the shelf. It's quite a thrill.
Nice, I know.
Oh, you're published by Algonquin. And, so that's,
you know,
nice
you can
press.
Kind of get it anywhere.
That's good news.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not one of those vanity publications where it's only...
No, it's a major...
It's a real publisher.
And Algonquin has been great.
That's a really nice house, actually.
Yeah, they've lived up to... They've surpassed their reputation as being a good house.
Yeah.
I love
how
that.
How appropriate... Yeah. That you, an editor at the New Yorker magazine, would be published by the Algonquin Press. Do you see the beautiful symmetry of that?
I do.
Well, very cool. And I want to thank all our guests. I mean, Ariane Batterbury
was
talking about hotels in the 18th century. Fascinating. Yeah. Christina Tosi, you know, young, energetic girl, you know,
absolutely
who's
charming,
risen to such heights as success.
Talented, yeah.
And, you know, John Donahue.
And now
thank
the wonderful
so
John
much.
Donahue. Yeah. Thanks for coming for such
Man
a short.
With a pen.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Jack. And thanks to our sponsor, Fairway Market. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This story comes off of MarketWire. Totally Green enters the U.S. hotel market with Orca, O-R-C-A, Green Machine, installed at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. Totally Green Incorporated, a pioneer in organic food processing systems and compostable packaging alternatives, has installed its revolutionary Orca Green Machine at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston. Four Seasons Hotels have implemented the Orca Green Machine to establish on-site composting of organic food waste generated by its restaurant and cuisine services. The organic composter saves the hotel tipping or disposal costs. The organic refuse produced by the hotel no longer needs to be hauled away. The Orca Green Machine composts up to 2,400 pounds of organic refuse per day into harmless, nutrient-rich gray water that can be safely put into the sanitary sewer system. The Four Seasons Hotel staff deposits any organic food waste generated throughout the hotel's guest rooms and restaurants into the composting machine. This aerobic compost process complements Four Seasons' environmental mission to support sustainability by reducing the amount of methane-producing organic material that they send to landfills. Well, kudos to the Four Seasons Hotel chain, because everybody could do that if they wanted to spend the money. I thought that was a really interesting story. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
There's no problem that Dave Arnold can't solve on his show, Cooking Issues. Take a little listen.
So Naveen writes in and says, "Hi Dave, I'm fascinated by chocolate, especially the transformation from the bitter seeds of the cacao tree to a tasty chocolate bar. That is a very interesting transformation. Are there any other foods that undergo a similar set of steps, fermentation, roasting, grinding? Also, do you know of any other tropical fruit seeds that could become delicious through such a process? Thanks, Naveen." That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously coffee, right? Coffee goes through a similar set of procedures, quite literally, fermentation, drying, roasting, grinding, brewing. And vanilla goes through picking, fermentation, right? It's dipped in, usually in boiling water, and then wilted and then fermented. So it's similar. And then I guess it can be ground to form a paste. But vanilla doesn't taste like vanilla until it goes through its paces to be fermented. In fact, the vanilla that's uncured is called red vanilla. You can get it. It's interesting.
If you like what you hear, you can hear a new show every Tuesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, or subscribe to the podcast, or check out the archives on our website. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.